Hello, this is Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips for you and your family to make your life easier. Tonight, my special guest is returning again. Thank you. His name is Scott Elmore, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about Scott. He is a doctoral candidate of clinical forensic psychology. He holds a master's degree in counseling psychology, marriage and family therapy, as well as a master's degree in clinical forensic psychology. He is an adjunct professor for both the Chicago School of Professional Psychology and University of Phoenix. Scott's area of research is in the area of high-profile mass killings and the impact of media has upon their juries. He is currently a psychology extern at Orange County Central Jail. His dissertation was titled The Insanity Defense, Public Opinion and the Public's Tendency to Implicate Mental Illness in High-Profile Crimes. Hi, Scott. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you. This sounds very intriguing. Could you talk a little bit about the research that went into your dissertation?
A lot. It was a lot of research that went into it. Actually, yeah, we can talk a lot about it. I think it's relevant right now because we just had a shooting up in Santa Barbara.
Right.
And every time we have one of these sort of mass shootings, the media just jumps all over it and starts making these sort of knee-jerk reactions. And that is exactly what my dissertation was about, was sort of how misinformation gets construed and how the population sort of absorbs it and reacts to it. And then really what's accurate and what's not accurate. And so right now we're seeing that coming out of this Isla Vista shooting where Mr. Roger had 10 different crime scenes and shot several people up there. And one of the diagnoses that the media is grabbing a hold of is that he had Asperger's syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And that not only he had Asperger's syndrome, but that in the Sandy Hook shooting that took place in, was it Connecticut, that gentleman also had Asperger's, which may or may not have been accurate. Certainly that wasn't the activating event for either one of these, in my opinion. But now that Asperger's is suddenly becoming a violent crime. And so my dissertation sort of looks at those things.
Mm-hmm.
And looks at the perception that the media has on people in presenting these ideas and sort of pounding it in their heads.
Right. And then people are confused to say exactly what is going on. And as you stated before, it's the misinformation.
Oh, yeah.
And then people start getting paranoid about, okay, well, I know somebody that has Asperger's or that person's acting weird. So let's put that label on him or her. Asperger's, okay, because we can't explain it. So all of a sudden, we're labeling people out of fear because of all of this media mass hysteria.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Just this year, and last year too, I guess, we had a new iteration of the DSM-5, or the DSM, our Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disease, which is sort of the book that clinicians go off of. Asperger's is gone now, so it's not even a term we use anymore, so we sort of lump it all into autism, and we look at autism as a spectrum disorder. So Asperger's is sort of, the way we think about that is its own illness, its own set of characteristics is gone anyhow. It did exist. It's not existing now. It doesn't mean it's not going to come back.
Right.
It's just sort of the way the DSM ebbs and flows.
Just a different label.
Yeah, just a different label. Yeah, we like labeling. Our field, we label. Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Yeah, that's precisely it. But this is not a illness of violence. It's a sort of an illness of seclusion. And so that's one big difference about this. But, you know, it's, again, the media grabs this. We're really looking to understand. As a society, I think we really want to understand what makes somebody go off, snap, and do these horrific crimes. So generally, schizophrenia is the culprit. And schizophrenia isn't necessarily a crime of violence either.
Right.
But the media loves schizophrenia. We use schizophrenia. Anytime something happens, it's schizophrenia. So I was really shocked when it was Asperger's this time. And, you know, the gentleman may or may not have had Asperger's. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. But again, it's certainly not a violent crime. But we love just finding labels. I think it makes us feel better. It makes us be able to compartmentalize what's happening with us. That, you know, so I don't have that. This person doesn't have that. So I feel safe. Or maybe they do have that. And we can sort of just label it. We can understand it. We can put it in a box. It just makes it easier for us.
Right. It makes it more, I guess, tangible mm-hmm. and manageable.
Sure.
Because after shootings like this, people want to be able to feel like they're back in control of their own little worlds, wherever they may be. Right. You know, especially if they're like a college student mm-hmm. or they were close by or,
oh, yeah.
I mean, the need to be more in control of one's physical surroundings after that is, it's almost like hypervigilant for some people, correct?
Yeah, correct. Absolutely. Yeah. And it feels very out of control. And when somebody, I don't know, I sort of liken it to a salmon when they sort of are swimming upstream doing their own thing and everyone else is going the other direction, all of a sudden it feels very uneasy, very uncomfortable. And we really need to sort of identify that. And why did that happen? The reality is we don't know. There's lots of potential culprits to that. But to just say this is the reason or these two things were the reason, it's very difficult to determine that. And that's one of the pushes that are coming out of this is trying to, out of this particular shooting and any shooting, but right now in the media, what's going on around Santa Barbara and the media is trying to sort of isolate and predict, if you will, the behaviors that are going to determine who is going to be the next mass shooter and who is just sort of thinking about those sorts of things. So those are two very different people.
Yes.
Lots of people have feelings of rage or feelings of sort of irrational thoughts, but they're not particularly violent. That's okay. Then lots of people then don't step over into the violence, but mm-hmm. sort of doing a risk assessment and determining who then is going to take that next step and become violent. That's a very difficult and dangerous sort of proposition for society to just sort of go in there and start grabbing people who are acting a little bit bizarre, a little bit crazy, and say, well, I think you might be the next person who's going to act violently towards people, and we're going to take some radical step against you. It's just not that easy.
It isn't. It really isn't. I mean, we still have freedoms in this country. And just to sit there and try to predict who is going to be the next mass shooter has to be damn near impossible.
Yeah.
Seriously, because, you know, I mean, we were talking about before with the police up in Santa Barbara, they had a run-in with Aaron Rodgers. Now, it was 3 months before.
About 3 months ago, something like that.
Yeah. And as you were discussing before, he probably had some really good manipulation techniques, and he was able to pretty much BS his way through that encounter. He was able to maybe bamboozle his parents and his therapists. And, you know, I mean, there are psychopaths out there that have those manipulation skills down to a fine art.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And I think we saw a lot of that in this case. You know, the police are limited. They have limited resources and limited training in this. And that's the unfortunate situation. They're not mental health experts, and we don't expect them to be. We don't train them to be mental health experts. When the officers go out and assess these groups of people, and I'm sort of at the edge of here of my expertise on this. I'm not a police psychologist, but I'm sort of comfortable in discussing what they do, but I've certainly never trained police officers. Mm. They're not looking for the nuances, to my understanding, the nuances, a mental health nuance of what's happening. So they're playing by the same rule book that all of us play from, which is assessing dangerousness. So as we were talking about earlier, you know, there's three ways to get yourself into a psychiatric hold, or a 5150 we call it, right?
Right.
So you're looking for dangerousness to others, dangerousness to yourself, or grave disability. And that's it. That's a vehicle that we have, you know. Now, there's wiggle room in each of those sort of categories that as clinicians we use. But you need to express a danger to yourself, a danger to others, or that you cannot take care of yourself. Like, if we leave you alone, not good things are going to happen to you. And that's it. And if you're able to, even if you have all kinds of craziness going on around you, if you're able to explain to the police that none of those three apply to you, they're probably going to leave you alone because they don't have the immediate grounds right then to put you on a mandatory hold.
Right. They have to see that type of behavior right at that moment.
Exactly.
Instead of hearsay, because for many, many years before that the criteria for 5150 went into place, people would be calling up. They would be trying to institutionalize their friends or family, and that was kind of way out of control. So now we've got some strict criteria for calling in a 5150.
Right. And that's our criteria right now. I mean, there was a time in our country where, you know, the vans would drive around and we could pick up anyone we would want and hospitalize you. To a greater or lesser degree, that stopped. And probably that's a good thing. The vast majority of the population does not get hospitalized. But in certain situations, we're not able to hospitalize people that probably do need to be hospitalized in a timely manner. So it's a lot more difficult to get people hospitalized against their will.
Yeah, well, and again, how many of the psychiatric hospitals have closed down since the 80s? A tremendous amount.
Yeah, so we have like, 4 open right now in California.
Right, that's it.
Yeah.
That's sad there, too. If the listeners would like to participate in this conversation, call up and ask questions, make comments, please call in at 800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. We were discussing before, Scott and I, that with so few mental health hospitals in the state of California now, that many of the mentally ill population are now going into the jail system. Can you discuss that a little bit, Scott?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, I work in Orange County, and we have a rather small population by comparison in terms of counties. And our psych ward, if you want to call it, in jail is full all the time. LA County is gigantic. And they have, rather boast, one of the largest psychiatric facilities in the nation in terms of their jail system, like Men's Central Jail. The amount of people they service in their psych ward up there, it's like a state psych hospital, you know. And the clinicians it takes to run it and this sort of thing. Ours is small by comparison, but full and compacted all the time. And that's, I think, just a statement of where we are as a society. We don't have the resources on the outside for people to go anymore since the deinstitutionalization, like you said, in the 80s. We had just very severely mentally ill people out roaming the streets and nowhere to go. And so the issue is then there needs to be a place where they can go to get services. And just as we were saying earlier, when the police get called, this is a group of people that cannot say no. In the case of Mr. Rogers, he was able to manipulate his way out of that and even wrote in his diatribe.
The manifesto.
Thank you so much. Yes. That if that had gone the other way, if they had spent more time, that they would have uncovered his plan and this sort of thing. So you can really feel the manipulative nature of him. But there needs to be a way for, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought here, the police to be able to intervene with these people who are in need of service and take them someplace that's not the county jail or the prison or someplace that is that's a stopgap. Because jail is not the place for them. Prison is not the place for them. It's not necessarily illegal to be mentally ill. Right. The acts that they're committing due to their mental illness, you know, are legal. potentially, but the act just of being mentally ill is not a crime.
And for so, any of us, right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and that needs to be, you know, that information needs to be getting out there more, I think, you know, versus people that are afraid to come forward and say, hey, you know what, I've got a mental health issue here. I need to have some help.
Yeah.
And having that help available, mm-hmm. although there are more avenues now to be getting the help that one needs, which is fantastic. But hopefully they get it at the beginning of this process, you know, versus once it's too late and, you know, after these mass shootings, because these are happening more and more, people. This is a scary thing. This, to me, is the canary in the coal mine. What is happening to our society here that they feel this is the only way that they can finally, you know, release all of this tension and anger of, you know, whatever's going on in their brains. It's just, it's tragic.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely the most flamboyant way of doing that. There's certainly other ways of releasing that, but they've chosen the most exaggerated way of releasing those tensions and emotions and rage and all of this sort of thing.
So what are some of the personality traits of mass shooters?
Gosh, that's a good question. You know, a lot of narcissism, certainly. Right. I mean, we saw that over and over with this gentleman, Mr. Rogers, but in a lot of the other ones, you definitely need a flair for the eccentric, I would think.
And dramatic.
Yes, yes.
Highly dramatic.
With Mr. Roger, I'm sorry, I'm just going back through a lot of the image. I've never seen a person with so many selfies. You know, looking back at just all the news footage and this sort of thing, for somebody, it just seems so contradictory to me. For somebody that has so many issues of being lonely and whatnot and not making friends and all this sort of thing, the profile images that you see of him are not like that at all. He portrays a very different person. And so I think there's that level of either it's just manipulation going on, like perhaps he's even manipulating himself. There's definitely a grandiosity that's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
And with the manifesto, like some mania, I think perhaps. So there's some, like along with that grandiosity, like some manic thinking. So something that's rising him above everybody else. So I think you're seeing that in others too. Like there's they see themselves as sort of a higher level thinker than others, that they're going to sort of rise above all of this and they can create this master plan. And it just unfortunately doesn't work out for them.
Yeah. And it's painfully lonely, because that is one of the things he kept on coming back to is, look at all these happy couples. I hate them. I'm jealous of them. I want a girl. Why don't girls want me? So there's that deep sense of not belonging with somebody else, loneliness. That when I was reading the manifesto, that kept coming back.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder about that.
How so?
You know, I've read that too, over and over and over again. As I've, not just the manifesto, but I've read, you know, other parts where he was discussing the loneliness aspect. It seems so incongruent with me, with how you see, again, the images of him, the videotapes of him. He seems rather gregarious and engaging. I don't know. I don't know. Without meeting him, without knowing him, without talking to him, obviously we're not going to know that. And I'm not as clinician. Something just doesn't fit for me there. So I'm not saying that I don't believe that he's a lonely guy. It just doesn't fit for me.
That's interesting. So almost like two separate personalities.
Yeah, one that he's writing about and one that he's living. And they don't, it's like they, They're probably touching, you know, and somewhere between there is the reality, like a little Venn diagram. But there's almost like two completely different circles for me.
Yeah. Yeah, no dialogue between the two, which does happen to people, which is very fascinating to watch.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. And so perhaps that is where his struggle is the juggling those two personalities? I don't know. And so where and how that becomes violent, how that interprets into this violent act, you know, my guess is that there's an underlying psychiatric disorder that either is diagnosed or undiagnosed, something we haven't heard about yet. Most often in these cases of mass shootings and this sort of thing, there's a diagnosable mental disorder that follows them. Something that is occurring in their brain where their brain chemistry is just not exactly as it should be, functioning as well as it should be. That's sort of generating a lot of these, pushing a lot of these buttons. So my feeling is there's something else going on there that fits with my thinking on this, along with the mania and some other things that I would have picked up on in terms of reading this that would have pushed that for me. So I don't know that, to me, it's just a complete personality disorder, a complete personality issue.
Which are very hard to treat.
Yes,
they are.
Yes, they are. And they want to be treated.
That's right.
Those personality issues are fun.
Yeah, those access to diagnoses are very, very difficult for anybody.
They are.
Yes. So we're going to come back to that. Okay. I would like the listeners to know that I am doing therapy in Cerritos, California. If you would like to come see me, my phone number is 562-234-4650. Or email me at jgood8@verizon.net and contact me about anything. I'd love to hear from you, okay? We're going to take a small musical break. Thanks. Welcome back to Psych One-on-One with Julianne Good. And my special guest is Scott Elmore. And we are discussing the theories and the whole, findings and understandings about the mass shootings, especially the Isla Vista mass murder that happened recently. So, Scott, is it possible to predict who will commit the next mass murder?
Always a good question. I think the media wants us to be able to predict that. I just don't know that we're going to be able to. We have a lot of violence predicting tools that we use as psychologists. In terms of how people are feeling about, let me restart this. In terms of if people have committed violence before. And then how they're thinking about maybe committing violent acts, in the future, this sort of thing. We look at a lot of indicators just in their life to sort of look at how they would think about committing violent acts. So we have lots of sort of tools based on risk assessment that we can use. But this, you're talking about somebody who's going to commit a mass killing is almost like a different character altogether. This is not somebody necessarily who is maybe going to be doing domestic violence or road rage or something, stalking behavior, something that would seem a little more ordinary, where a lot of our risk tools are maybe more geared towards, have been traditionally geared toward in the past. I don't know that we have a good answer for that right now. I have not seen any research or material to this point that's led us any closer to knowing, who or where or why or who to look for and this sort of thing. I mean, as I was saying earlier, a lot of people share irrational thoughts about a group of people or people who could have, violent or raging thoughts. But then they don't commit a crime. They don't commit a violent act. And so I would still sort of consider that in a healthy realm, And so what's the difference between those who are able to control that and the ones who aren't able to control that? We're not even close to there yet, in my opinion, to sort of figuring that out, that leap out. And
so I would imagine that with the increase of these mass shootings, that forensic researchers and psychologists and police are going to get to the point where they're going to start piecing things together and putting all of these behaviors and patterns together, mm-hmm. and sooner or later they are going to be able to predict, hopefully, when this is going to happen.
Yeah,
with a versus just waiting for the shoe to drop and then we all have to deal with it somehow. I mean, that's that's my hope and my prediction that there is going to be some good that's going to come out of this.
I would hope so. I still think it's a very risky business, though.
Yeah.
Because the two people, it's a very individualistic decision. Two people could have the same stressors yet face it very differently. And so I sort of feel like it's a Minority Report thing, where just because I have a lot of stressors in my life, doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to go off and commit a violent act, mm-hmm. whereas the person next to me may. And how would given the same set of facts, how would you know who would and who wouldn't? Does that mean that we're going to monitor them differently? And so one of the issues that's coming out of Santa Barbara right now is mm-hmm. forced medication. So if Elliot Rogers had been forced to take medication, would this have changed? And so there's a new law in California right now that had just come up, Jamie's Law, I think, or something of this, where it's talking about forcing medication on people. And so that sort of this came up on the heels of that. And that law is really dealing with a very small group of people who, after they do what's called a rehearing, where they have to go in front of a judge and get an order to force medication, that this group sort of gets smaller, then we're able to actually streamline that process and make it legal for us to administer medication when someone doesn't want to give medication, what doesn't want to take medication, and this mm-hmm. sort of thing. So it's a huge legal process in terms of forcing medication on people, on an adult or somebody who's conserved or this sort of thing, right? So, but we're talking about like an ordinary adult walking around who has the capability of deciding whether or not they're going to take medications. And so what one of the things that's coming out of this is, you know, can we take psychiatric patients, and that's a very loose term, and force them to take medication? So I don't know about that.
Right. What happens to free will?
What happens to free will? Yeah. I mean,
yeah. And then the whole thing is too, you know, medication for certain individuals is life-saving.
Absolutely.
But it is not an end-all, cure-all for everybody. And see, there's the tricky thing, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And we go back to, if we can go back a little bit to those three things we hospitalize people for, you know, the one of which is gravely disabled. And in that case, when people are legitimately gravely disabled, often those are the group who get forced medications.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not gravely disabled, though, that's a hard argument to make. If you're able to make decisions for yourself, answer questions for yourself, drive yourself around, drive a black BMW around, make lucid videotapes of yourself, take selfies, that's a hard argument to make to force that person to take medication.
Yeah, or hospitalized or jail them against their will. Yes.
Yeah, if you're laying under a bus bench or something, that would be maybe an easier argument to make. I don't know. So there's a lot of policy, I think. There's always a lot of policy that come out of an incident like this, where we're going to try to make sort of a legal change, policy change, social change, and this sort of thing. And I think the intention behind it is always good. The application scares me. You know, as a human, and then as a clinician, you know, I get worried about where we're going to go with some of these things. And so one of which, and we were talking earlier, maybe before the show about this, is, you know, right now when we are putting somebody on a hold, we're looking at these three things: danger to self, danger to others, and gravely disabled. Are we going to have other tools, you know, down the line to really be able to assess risk, to assess dangerousness, to do something, maybe broaden our scope? I don't know. That would be interesting to know, to look at, to see if not only us, but the law enforcement, fire, paramedics, you know, somebody, first responders, people who have access to people when they're critical, would have a different set of tools at their disposal. That would be interesting to know.
Right. I mean, I think it's going to get to the point where there are going to be biomedical markers
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that they are going to be able to take, maybe like a blood sample, urine sample, mm-hmm. something like that. And it's going to say, okay, you know, their brain chemistry is off or something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm forecasting that something like this is going to end up happening. I love science fiction too, but
right,
you know,
like
just the medical advances, like in spec scanning, PET mm-hmm. scanning, fine MRI imaging. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that is going to start giving us a little more real data behind what is going on with why psychopaths decide to do these kind of crimes.
That I completely agree with. The way we are doing things now honestly hasn't changed since pretty much Freud was roaming around. I mean, we really look at things dynamically. We talk to people. We listen to them. We assess them. We stare at our book. We interpret what they're saying via the text that we have in front of us, and we make decisions based upon that. And that is, that's really how we do our job. The tools have changed a little bit. They've updated. Like I said, we're now at DSM-5. So the way our psychological tests and thinking and this sort of thing has evolved, you know, over the years. So that's keeping current, I guess, arguably. But the way we're actually performing our job really hasn't changed since Freud has been roaming around.
Right, and then you get clinician biases.
Oh, my gosh.
You have one person interviewing that criminal. They can pick up on something else. Then you get another person coming in mm-hmm. with different training, different criteria that they're trying to look for. Oh, yeah. So then you have all these, you know, this piecemeal picture of this criminal.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the criminal, of course, has these fine manipulation tools down to a T. Yeah, it's incredible. I've worked with a few of those types of people when I've been working in an emergency room, and they are slick.
Yes, they are. Yeah, I have a few of my caseload, and they are. You know what?
Charming.
They survive.
Yes.
Right, and so they have a skill set they've adopted to be able to survive in their environment, and. You know, the clinician needs to understand that as well, that these are coping skills, right? So everybody has coping skills,
yes.
And these are just learned skills. And my guess is that Mr. Elliot Rogers, he had a set of learned coping skills that he had to figure out too to survive. And we all have to manage in our own environment.
Mm-hmm.
So what his manipulative skills were or his shyness, or I don't know, whatever he was dealing with in his own skin is things he had to cope with it and learn to cope with in his environment as well.
Right, which we will never know of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The medication issue, though, is going to be very interesting to watch. I mean, there's going to be so many laws that come out of, or try to come out of this, because this is, you know, every time we have an incident like this, and they're horrible, everyone is awful, and they seem to just be getting worse. But I feel like there's going to be an intolerance point, you know, where we're going to try to make some drastic change or policy change. You know, it's just a society to try to wrap our arms around this.
So what do you predict along those lines?
Now that I don't know.
Oh, come on, Scott, throw something out there. I already threw my prediction out there.
I don't know what my prediction is.
Get your crystal ball out.
I know. I hope it's not some sort of forecasting thing. But, my first thought is a penalty thing, but so often they don't live through this. Either the vast majority of shooters are either taking their own life or some sort of person intervening is ending it for them. So very few of these people are surviving this incident.
Do you know if there's any kind of autopsy afterwards on these shooters? Have you run across that in any of the research that you were doing?
That's interesting.
Because if I were on that other end, I would definitely want to be doing an autopsy on those brains.
Yeah, that's a good question. I suspect there is, but I haven't really looked. So that's an interesting question. You know, I'm going to research that now that you brought that up.
Yeah, that might be a topic for another show.
Yeah, I'll have to follow up on that.
If there is that type of research, because I would want to be doing that.
Specifically if they're saving the brains and looking at those. I know we're saving the brains of like football players and whatnot, looking at TBIs
mm-hmm.
and this sort of thing. So it'd be interesting if they're actually collecting the brains of these folks. I don't know. That's an interesting subject. I imagine, you know, they're keeping or preserving, you know, some data on this, but not one that I've seen. But then again, I haven't specifically been looking for that. So that is interesting. I'll look at this. In terms of the crystal ball, I just don't know. My feeling is it's going to be something else. It's going to be a change like more resource officers in schools or something like this, that are able to engage these people at an earlier instance. You know, now this was a little bit different because this was a citywide shootout. So this wasn't necessarily a campus shooting, a theater shooting, elementary school
contained.
Shooting. Yeah, exactly. So from that standpoint, it was a little different feel of a shooting, of an incident to it. They're all just different, though. Every single one of them are different. And my feeling is that they're not going to plan. That there's that sort of grandiose thinking that if the gentleman was able just to get into the sorority, let's say, that would have probably been it for him. But that didn't work. So then plan B is you got to run around the city and do things. And because that didn't work for him, the plan starts falling apart very quickly. What do we call it? Like magical thinking?
Yeah.
In a sense, like there's just this sort of thought process that we're just not going to understand going on in the head of a lot of these folks. And it plays out in what their mind is just a much higher level than you and I are capable of processing. That's how they see it. We don't understand. They understand, we don't understand.
And you wonder, too, if it's a sense of ultimate control. They, in their minds, have maybe some, like you were talking about before, superiority mm-hmm, complex. Mm-hmm. A God complex. Mm-hmm. I'm in control. I make the decision whether you live or die right now.
Sure, absolutely.
Pretty much.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Definitely. And that all works into that sort of what I would call mania.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly what I would, it's exactly what I think. And then I think if it had worked out how he had planned it, it would have been a very isolated event. Meaning it would have taken place in one, like a controlled environment would have taken place. You know, we would have had like two crime scenes, one at his house, one in a sorority, God forbid. And that would have been the incident, because in his mind, that's what he had wanted to do. But that didn't work out, thank goodness. And then we ended up having a whole different slew of events because in his mind, he couldn't put it back together again. So these are very disorganized minds.
Yes.
Despite how they view it. So I guess that's good and bad, I don't know.
So with the research that you did for your dissertation, did you come across any kind of reasoning from, why would a person commit a mass shooting?
They're so different. Each one is so, so different. I think one big reason is, I think if there's an underlying reason, it's probably like attention. It's a statement that they're going to make, and they're going to make a huge statement, not just a period, but an exclamation mark, right?
And they will be remembered somehow.
And they're going to be remembered. So there's sort of a notoriety that goes with it. But at the time, I'm not sure that that's how they're thinking about it. So I don't know that they go out the door thinking that this is going to be something that goes down in history. I just think in their mind that they go out the door thinking, well, this is going to be an incident that's going to take place. I think that with the possible exception of the Fort Hood one, where I think there's a political sort of a political motivation behind it. There was a religious motivation behind it. That one, I think, was really trying to get some attention to it. The Navy shipyard, I'm sort of going through some of these in my mind, where there were more isolated reasons. So typically in a shooting, in a killing, there's like an intended victim.
Mm-hmm.
So these are a very different type of killing, where you've got sort of a spree killing. You've got an act where you want to sort of be bigger than life and commit a crime. So the Aurora, Colorado shooting, the theater shooting, this sort of thing, where you're going to try to make yourself a little bit larger and sort of cause a scene. Sorry about that. In the Jared Loughner shooting of Gabrielle Giffords. He was super disorganized, had a bit of a fixation, but talk about somebody who was just really disorganized and obviously violent. And okay, so let's back up a little bit. You can have, even like within psychosis, you can have like command hallucinations and this sort of things. So people within your head telling you to do things.
Right.
So there's lots of different reasons why people just commit crimes in general and not necessarily huge, violent, like mass murder type crimes. So sort of conceptualizing it from that way, taking out that personality aspect of it, taking out that sort of grandiosity aspect of it, it's already difficult to sort of wrap your head around why somebody would just take a random person's life. Knowing that, once again, the vast majority of people who are killed are probably intended victims, all right? So then you get somebody who's not an intended victim, who's just a random victim. That's already confusing enough. Then you get several victims in one incident, and it sort of becomes, it balloons out and possibly becomes not about the killing at all, but about some sort of a look at me type thing. Look what I'm doing. In the case of Aaron Alexis, when he was going into Sandy Hook, mm-hmm. he was going after more of a specific target, but was killing people along the way. But there was a lot of psychosis and delusion happening there. So it's tough to say, like, one person and one crime, like, you could just fit them all together. They're right. All so different.
Yeah, one profile does not fit all.
No. It's why it's fascinating to you know, investigate them, to talk to them, supposing they live through this, or read or you know, sort of do a profile on each one of them, because there are a lot of traits that are the same. And I think I mentioned this the last time I was here, but, you know, one of the tests that we do, which is the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. So it's a very standard for, test that we do in psychology. We've done it for many, 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 many years. And it gives a very valid personality index on people.
Right.
And over the years, they've done MMPIs on serial killers.
Jeffrey Dahmer. I saw his recently.
Yeah.
High, very high on the antisocial scale.
Yeah.
Huge. Yeah. Yes.
When you look at the big famous serial killers and you stack all of theirs on top of one another, they're almost identical. So fascinating that through the years, the big serial killers who have, you know, I'm talking like Gacy and Bundy and Dahmer mm-hmm. and these sorts of things. So their profiles are almost identical. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really fit the same pattern. So at some level, there's a process that's co-occurring in all of them, right? So the same level of thinking is happening. The motivations are probably different. Now, sadly, to one extent, the mass shooters generally aren't living through these. So right. We're not able to test them. We're not able to really look at their brains at the same level. We're not able to understand them that way. But with the serial killers, we have been able to. And so I would be very interested to have looked at that study to see if at some level, if at some brain sort of chemistry level, there is a commonality between them. And we're obviously not getting that chance. But psychologically, I think that would be fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, most definitely. So what type of a societal component would you say is fueling these mass murders? Is there any?
What type of societal component? That's an interesting question.
Yeah. What do you think is happening now that's fueling this anger?
I think we have an angry society.
Yeah.
I mean, that's certainly it, but I'm not sure what. who they're angry with. Yeah, that's a huge question. That's a good question. No, I'll take it.
Yeah, another research paper. Right?
I'll take it for $10. Who are they angry with? Gosh, we have an angry society, and I'm not sure if we're angry because societies are so far apart culturally, maybe, and do they feel that way in some areas, or they're far apart economically. I don't really know. It just feels very tense to me, and has. We've had, you know, huge incidences where we've seen rioting and whatnot, you know, just in the last, I don't know, decade or a few more years beyond that, and also where we've come together. But we've also created these people out of society that have done these horrific crimes, and they're part of us too. So are they coming out of their families? Is it coming out of their families? Are they a product of their environment, their own neighborhoods, or, you know, I don't know. I don't know. A lot of these folks, you know, seem to be coming out of, like, loving families. Some of them, anyway, coming out of loving families. Some of them, maybe families aren't as well functioning. It's a really tough question to answer.
And there's so many factors that go into it.
Yeah.
Many factors. Thank you. And, you know, just to wrap up, Scott, because actually we could go on with this with part two, and I'd love to have you on for part two, but I understand you're moving soon up to the northern part of California, so but we could do this by phone.
Yeah.
I would love to continue this conversation because... And this is one of the topics that I like to revisit, because I think it's so important to get this information out there and to let people know these are the types of people that are being, you know, created more and more. What can we do about it? Can we get more understanding and maybe look for more of the signs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, when you see some of these signs, say something to somebody else and saying, you know what, this is a little unusual and I'm a little concerned about it. You know, pass a word on, try to maybe get the person help if that is possible.
Exactly. Yeah.
But start getting involved instead of shutting down and doing tunnel vision and just going out with your own life, because we're all in this together. We need to be taking care of each other, and hopefully...
Oh, that's so true.
Yeah. So if anybody would like to contact you, how can they do so?
Oh, they can... they can email me. That's probably the best way. And my email is Smith, S-M-I-T-H, S-S-M-I-T-H, 11, at alliant.edu. That's S-S-M-I-T-H, 11, at alliant, A-L-L-I-A-N-T, .edu. It's probably the best way to get a hold of me. And I generally respond to email promptly.
Wonderful.
Generally.
Wonderful. Scott, I really appreciate you being back on again. Thank you so much.
I love it. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much for this really important information and for all of your knowledge, and... keep on going with all that research.
Let's do part two soon.
Let's do part two, exactly. Thank you so much. And if anybody would like to contact me, my contact information is jgoode8@verizon.net. And my office phone number is 562-234-4650. If you couldn't get to this whole interview, this will be archived within 24 to 48 hours. At skidrowstudios.com and also at iTunes. And we are also on Stitcher and Facebook. So please contact me. I would love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your concerns and questions and ideas for more shows. That would be wonderful. So this has been Julianne Good for Psych 1-on-1. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.